We've got a great overtime lined up for you today. Alabama's only union talk radio program, The Valley Labor Report. My name is Jacob Morrison. My co-host is Adam Keller. We're going to be talking about some news surrounding the homeless population here in Huntsville, some really cool Starbucks news, some not so cool Starbucks news. I'm going to have a discussion with Josh Moon about Alabama politics potentially. Still waiting on that. Talking about some Elon Musk tweets. Lots of good stuff. Adam is going to be keeping an eye on the Zoom, and we'll just go ahead and bring Josh on as once he jumps in. If you would like to be a part of the program, give us a call. The phone number is 844-899-TVLR. That's 844-899-8857. Taking a look at the YouTube chat, we had lots of discussion during the cop segment. During the main show, and lots of things I agree with in here. Austin Jones says in the YouTube chat, if you look at Fox Local in Huntsville, it's all gun violence and fear mongering. And that is like basically what local news is. We do have a really cool local news segment that we're going to clip here in a little bit, though, that was really cool. I enjoyed that a lot. Huntsville announced some crazy high clearance rate, Austin said. Don't believe it. I would be interested in what their published clearance rate is. Drop that in the chat if you recall. Jimmy says, FBI stat, law enforcement prevents violent crime only 4% of the time. I don't doubt that. Austin says, as a reply to that, I thought it was 3%. Wow, so that's a 33% increase. They just arrest random citizens and call it a day. That happens sometimes, certainly. If a plane lands 4% of the time, that's not a good plane. Agreed. Huntsville cop budget is like 51% of the budget. I wouldn't doubt it. Jimmy says, I wish I could organize unionize labor in my field. It'd be great. Austin says, you can. What's your field? Jimmy says, public defender. So, Jimmy, check out that article that I dropped in the chat about public defenders in Fredericksburg, Virginia, unionizing with the IWW.
Yeah, that really may be helpful for you.
Yeah, I wrote it. And of course, you can send us a DM on Facebook or Twitter, and I can get you in touch with those people in Fredericksburg, and they can talk to you about unionizing wherever you're at, because I know that they'd be willing to help. They announced that they were unionizing with like 90% of the people in their office, and literally weeks later they announced a $7,000 a year raise. $7,000 a year is pretty substantial for most working people. So that was very cool. We're going to have to get them on the program at some point, because not only are they unionizing with the IWW, not only are they unionizing with the IWW in a heavily ununionized field like public defense, they're also doing it in the South, which is fascinating.
Absolutely.
Very cool. Very cool. Austin says, much love, thanks, as if he's leaving. And then he said, just a break. Yeah. Yeah, buddy. Yeah, we got a whole hour and a half of content left. You got to hang around. We do like 3 hours every Saturday, unless something crazy happens. So make sure you stay around.
Thanks for everyone tuning in and chatting in. You guys always have great discussions in the chat. I always learn things. Really, so keep it coming. Keep it coming. We appreciate it. And if you guys have any ideas on interview, like guest interview ideas on labor history topics you want us to discuss or other issues you want us to discuss, definitely send it our way. Like, we don't do this just to hear ourselves talk. Jacob might, but, you know.
I mean, there's a certain amount of narcissism.
There may be some of that, but...
Yeah, there's a certain amount of narcissism that goes along with putting a microphone in front of your face.
That's true.
But, you know, we try to keep that to a minimum.
We know that the media in Alabama is lackluster. I think, to put it generously. And certainly if you are concerned about the labor movement, if you want to hear news and analysis of, by, and for the working class people here in Alabama and the South, not a lot of it. And so we're trying to, you know, hit that sweet spot and still provide some entertainment for people and hopefully some information for people. And yeah, any participation you guys have as viewers and listeners is very much appreciated.
Absolutely. So the first story that we were going to talk about in overtime is that Huntsville has sent a notice to residents of the Derrick North encampment that they are planning to evict its current residents and close the encampment without first securing individual housing for all encampment residents. Truly, truly disgusting stuff here by the city of Huntsville. And there are some groups I know that are organizing against this. The SPLC has filed a lawsuit against the city of Huntsville, as well as, I believe, did they file a lawsuit, or did they just send a letter? Maybe it was just a letter.
I'll have to check on that. I thought that they were basically threatening a lawsuit, that if they were to move forward with this.
Gotcha. Threatening a lawsuit.
But I'm not entirely sure at this time. I know there was a lot of developments over the last couple of days.
Yeah, it looks like in this article from the Alabama Political Reporter that they're just threatening a lawsuit. But that was published a day ago, so maybe this is
There has been some developments, is my understanding, just in the last couple of days. And I know while SPLC and the ACLU of Alabama, Alabama Rise, they're all involved, but also some
Love
more
Huntsville, Vote Huntsville,
the Huntsville Bail
Huntsville
Fund.
Bail Fund.
So it's a combination of like your more established nonprofits with very grassroots local folks, which that's great to see as well, to see that kind of coalition building happening, because I think it takes people who are on the ground. And it also takes those more established groups who do have the cachet to get in the news and to call upon legal resources.
Right.
So I'm happy to see that fight back. Yeah. Not happy to see what the city of Huntsville's doing.
The thing is that, I mean, even conservative Utah has gone with a housing first.
Right, because it's the fiscally conservative thing to do.
It's the fiscally conservative thing to do is just to give homeless people houses. Just give them a place to live.
It turns out it's very difficult to address other like pre-existing conditions, whether it's mental illness or drug addiction or unemployment, whatever the issues may be that are contributing to the homelessness. It's very difficult to address those while you don't know where you're going to sleep tonight.
Right.
Common sense.
Imagine trying to get a job, especially in the service sector, as a homeless person who has difficulty like securing a place to shower. Like, do you reckon, you know, Starbucks is going to hire you if you have trouble getting a shower?
Right. It's just
it doesn't make any sense to not and then if you can't find a job, well, then you're not going to be able to get a place to live. Well, then what happens if you don't have any income? You don't have a place to live. Well, maybe you go deeper into drugs, or you have to do some sort of illicit thing to get an income, right? And so it just doesn't make any sense as a fiscal matter. And this has been proven that by choosing homelessness as a policy choice, choosing to allow people to be homeless instead of providing housing for them is more costly, because you have to have other resources that are diverted to them through the criminal legal system and welfare programs that would not have to be diverted to them. There is less of an opportunity for them to come out of their economic destitution. It just doesn't make any sort of speaking just on a fiscal manner, which I think I think we should be able to kind of graduate from talking about fiscal, you know, these things as fiscal matters, to talking about these things as human matters, to talking about these things as oh, the people that are living under the bridge, like, they're my sisters and they're my brothers and they're my siblings and they're people that I should care about as humans,
absolutely,
right? I think that's something that we should be able to do. But even if we can't, if we can't graduate to that level, just on the basest, most cynical economic calculation, the choice to allow them to the choice to force them to be homeless is not economical, and clearing out camps does not address the issue.
No, it just
displaces them.
Right, which in my view, that's the goal here, is to just get rid of the camp, disperse the people so that it's no longer visible, right? Their goal would probably be to chase these people out of town and just hope that they leave, or that wherever they end up is in a less concentrated, less visible place. Something that I think is worth mentioning as well, from the SPLC's letter, is they talked about how many of the residents of this camp are disabled. They have limited mobility. They have special health needs. And, you know, to send the police in there to just bust up the camp and clear them out, I don't know how you can live with yourself. To order such a move, to execute such a move, because people are going to suffer, people are going to lose medicine. It's just disturbing. And like you said, I agree with you, Jacob. We shouldn't have to talk about it in terms of dollar and cents, because at the end of the day, there is something called humanity. And I know that, you know, political leaders are not really supposed to think that way. They're supposed to just think in terms of budgets and optics and PR. But we deserve so much better. So credit to the coalition of folks on the ground in Huntsville, as well as, you know, fighting from Montgomery and elsewhere to try to put a stop to this. And I hope they are successful. If anyone listening is part of this movement and you want to share more, you want to come on the show, whatever, please, by all means, tell us. I want to see the city of Huntsville do the right thing, work with these people, find housing, find health care, find services for these people. Just sending in police to destroy a camp, the only home these people have, is disgusting, and it's not acceptable. It was never acceptable, but it certainly shouldn't be acceptable in the year 2022.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In better news, though, Starbucks workers are continuing to rack up W's. You'll remember that workers in Birmingham won the first union election at a Starbucks in Alabama a couple weeks ago. Well, just this past week, workers at the Memphis location, where 7 workers were fired, won their election in a landslide 11-3, as was predicted by the fired workers right here on the Valley Labor Report. That same day, the union won elections in 11 other cities. Amazing. Amazing. The Memphis 7 had their hearing yesterday, so we'll be looking for the results of that and sharing that with you as we go forward.
Real quick, one fun statistic that I think you're touching on is that, and I just heard that this morning on my way here doing some prep, and if you look at the number of union elections in the United States, we have already... Where we're at the end of May is where we were at last year in October.
Wow.
So we are several months ahead of the pace of last year. Granted, you know, it's still lower than it needs to be. But I think being several months ahead in terms of the number of elections filed is thanks in large part to Starbucks Workers United and the massive organizing wave we've seen there. So We have to give a lot of credit to those folks and what they're doing to inspire labor organizers and activists all over the country and industry after industry.
Yeah, it's very cool. And right here in Alabama, we've got another store filing for election. Workers at a Scottsboro location filed for election last week. Scottsboro, for people that are not familiar with Alabama, is a pretty conservative little town.
I would say very conservative.
Very conservative little
town.
Not
a lot of diversity.
No.
It's you know, white, Appalachian kind of community.
I ran my fastest 5K in Scottsboro. I don't know if you know that little bit of trivia.
No, I didn't. Yeah. I know about the Unclaimed Baggage Center.
The Unclaimed
Baggage Center is cool as...
We're not on the radio. It's cool as shit, man. Go to the Unclaimed Baggage System. Or the Unclaimed Baggage Center. It's really cool.
Scottsboro is it's an interesting place because it used to be heavily... industrial. There was a lot of textile industry in that community, but of course, as with so many other communities over the decades, most of the industry has shut down and shipped out, and so it's a community that's in decline, really, in terms of population, in terms of employment opportunities. You know, what little bit I know from people in that area is, you know, if you want a good job, quote unquote good job, you're probably going to Huntsville to find it, or Chattanooga. You're not going to find a lot of options there. So I say all that just to kind of put it in context. And this is in Jackson County. And so we're talking the northeastern part of Alabama, kind of our side of Lookout Mountain. You go up the mountain and you can get to Chattanooga on the Tennessee side. So it's beautiful country. Very conservative religious area, certainly not the kind of place you would expect to be the second union at Starbucks in the state. And so I love that about it, that, you know, that's you talked earlier about the miners and how kind of there's been some unexpected support. You know, we're supposed to think, if we believe the media narratives, that like environmentalists and coal miners are at each other's throats. And so seeing Energy Alabama and Sierra Club support the coal miners on strike is really, it's a beautiful thing. And I think this is another beautiful thing, to see a community that, you know, we would stereotype as kind of very far right, hostile to unions. Here they are popping up with a union election. I think that's beautiful.
Yeah, and the Emily Mosner for WHNT interviewed a couple of the workers, and she and the person that I've clipped up for this interview, she mentions that. Let's go ahead and play that clip from an interview by Emily Mosner for WHNT.
The people that are going to say, like, we're just baristas, like, we're hourly workers, we don't deserve more than what we're getting now, please think about the fact that some of us have kids, and, like, we have school to go to, and, like, we need this job to be able to provide for ourselves. Like, be supportive of us pushing for better for ourselves. I know that there is, you know, saying union is a scary word, but it's not something to be scared of. We just want to be able to provide for ourselves and for our families.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great, and to see such an interview on local news, because I think...
How often do you get rank-and-file unionizing workers interviewed on local news talking about why they're unionizing? That's so cool.
And sharing that union is not a dirty word. There's nothing to be scared of. And hey, by the way, we're real people with kids and bills and real lives.
Right.
That's great. And that's just one of the other great things about this happening in a community like that, is to get the word out to other folks. Mm-hmm. Because I imagine there were probably people sitting in Athens and Decatur and Huntsville and Madison thinking, well, hell, if they can do it in Scottsboro, why not here?
That's what happened with Scott. In one of the other interviews, they said that they were inspired by Birmingham. They were like, oh, well, if Birmingham can do it, I can do it. How many more people are going to look at Scottsboro and say, if Scottsboro could do it, I can do it, right?
Absolutely.
That's just so, it's so awesome. So I'm really looking forward to elections popping up all over the state.
Yeah, and I think... you said Austin maybe mentioned this in the chat earlier about local news just being fear-mongering and gun violence and car crashes, and that is so true. Local TV news is mostly a joke, and that's not any disrespect to some of the folks that I've worked with personally over the years in these stations. I know they're doing the best they can and under their conditions, but...
their conditions are really crazy. Like,
they're bad.
If you ever talk
they
to...
They need to unionize.
Yeah, I mean, no kidding. No kidding. The reporters in Huntsville make significantly less than I do.
The pay is not good. The working conditions are crap. And that's, you know, before you even get to, like, editorial aspects and the content that they're asked to produce. So, yeah, what a breath of fresh air that instead of the latest car crash and mugging and shooting, that you have an inspiring story of workers in a rural community fighting back, fighting for their dignity and justice and for each other. Great news.
Incredibly, incredibly cool. Josh Moon's not in the chat or not in the Zoom yet, is he?
No, okay. I do not believe
Let's
so.
Go ahead and hit this then. It's not all sunshine and roses, though, for the Starbucks workers. Howard Schultz, Starbucks CEO, was interviewed by New York Times for Who the Hell Knows Why, and he had this to say about the union. Let's play that clip.
We have to demonstrate to our people they can trust us, and we have to show up.
Could you ever see doing that and embracing the union as part of it?
No.
Why not?
The primary reason is we are in business to exceed the expectations of our customers. 100 million people come into Starbucks. The customer experience will be significantly challenged and less than if a third party is integrated into our business.
Because they're not acting in good faith?
Because we have a different view. And Aaron, I don't want to spend the entire time in the union. Come on.
No, but I just want to understand it because there's headlines every day about this is at Starbucks, but this is everywhere else as well, Amazon and others. But I think there's a focus on is there a way for companies and unions potentially to work together? And you know, given how progressive your company has been, there's lots of people who look at Starbucks. I was looking at a headline: Starbucks is a latte liberal until it's not.
Well.
It's a mean headline. National Review, by the way, not the New York Times. But I only say it because I think that there's a question. Is there a way for both to live in harmony?
My belief is that we have built a company that is centered around exceeding the expectations of our people and our customers. And that is the vision we have for the future of the company.
Truly amazing.
Notice he never explains how the union is going to interfere with exceeding expectations of customers. They never can explain that. And when you listen to the stories, the interviews of these workers who are organizing, time and time again, they are incredibly generous to Starbucks as a company, frankly. They are always talking about how they want to do right by their customers. They want the store to be positive in the community. So it's completely contradictory to what's actually happening. I agree with Strom's comment in the chat that his business is to extract surplus value from the labor of the workers in Starbucks and the workers who helped grow the coffee beans, the workers who helped ship these items there to Starbucks all along the chain. You know, that's the business, to make a profit.
Yeah.
Customers are happy about it or not is secondary, and it only is a factor to the extent that it maintains profits.
And everybody that is reporting on this campaign, that has knowledge of this campaign, is amazed at how worker-led it is. And you can just look at the letters that are being sent out. Like, that's not common to have letters that are signed by the entire store, the entire facility for an organizing campaign sent to the CEO. Like, that's not a common tactic, and that they are willing to put their name to paper before they even have an election is a serious sign about how worker-led this campaign is. And so the idea that he, especially in this campaign, is trying to third-party these workers is amazing. amazing. Isabel Loveridge on Twitter said, quote, I order the inventory you profit off of. I do the dishes after we make thousands of dollars in just a few hours. I de-escalate situations in your store to keep your people safe. And I am a leader in the labor movement. I am not a third party, Howard Schultz.
Hell yeah. They want you to, like, visualize, I guess, some Jimmy Hoffa-like figure in D.C. or New York or Chicago pulling all the strings here.
Right.
Sorry, this is actually grassroots. This is actually coming from working people.
Yes.
Deal with it.
I also just want to say, totally a dereliction of duty by the facilitator, because you could see in that clip Howard Schultz get his feelings hurt, saying, you know, come on, I don't want to talk about the union the whole time. And it's like, well, what the hell else do I care about what you have to say other than what's going on with the union campaign?
That's kind of, like, a big deal with Starbucks right
now. Yeah, as far as Starbucks is concerned, the company and Howard Schultz, the CEO, there is nothing else that anybody should have any interest in hearing from them from. Like, there's nothing else that he has any relevant input on.
And, you know, if he wanted to have nicer headlines and to quiet this conversation, it would be incredibly easy.
Right.
Recognize the unions.
Recognize the union.
Sit down and bargain in good faith.
Yeah.
It's really not that hard. You don't. I mean, yes, there's always going to be opposition and contradiction there between labor and management, labor and capital. But not. Capital and business does not always have to take this kind of adversarial approach. And there are some companies out there, fewer these days, but there are some companies out there that are willing to just negotiate with the union, recognize the union, and move on and deal with it.
Right.
And actually work with the union to improve their products or services or whatever the case may be.
Because the union is the workers, so that's what you have to do, is you have to, you know, you have to work with your workers to actually make the product. And you know, the idea that the facilitator just let it go. Like, I went to the interview on YouTube because I wanted to see if there was anything else after that clip, but there's not. There's nothing else that they, the rest of the thing, they're talking about just inflation and politics and Joe Biden and Janet Yellen, and, like, who gives a shit? I don't care what Howard Schultz has to say about inflation, generally speaking, as a phenomenon. Like, who cares? And the idea that the facilitator just let it slide, like, oh, no, Howard Schultz is getting his little fifis hurt. Like, I'm going to stop talking about this. Like, who cares?
Well, you know, the business press and really the media more generally, they treat these folks as if they are our version of nobility, at least over in the old world. Over in Great Britain, they still have titles. They have their fancy titles and you know, distinctions of nobility. Here, they just call them CEOs. And we're supposed to be concerned about what their feelings are and what they think about matters of the day. And, you know, I can't get over the fact that this was a man who some people consider to be a potential presidential candidate,
who Hillary Clinton had picked to be the Secretary of Labor.
Yeah.
If she had won. Insane.
Right. It's, you know, that's corporate Democrats in a nutshell right there.
Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. But you know, this is clearly what he means, though, right? That he doesn't want to bargain in good faith. He doesn't see his workers. He does not see the people that actually do the thing at Starbucks location. He does not see them having an active role in determining the path forward for the company. He believes that he alone should be the decider of what Starbucks does moving forward. And that's what he said, and that's what he means, which is directly contradictory to everything that Starbucks has said officially in the past. More Perfect Union compiled a huge list of statements from Starbucks spokespeople in response to this clip coming out. More Perfect Union compiled a list of statements from Starbucks spokespeople saying that they would bargain in good faith, including from Schultz himself, who said in an earnings call, quote, "Where Starbucks is required to engage in collective bargaining, we will negotiate in good faith. Starbucks will not favor or discriminate against any partner based on union issues, and we will respect the right of Starbucks partners to make their own decisions when exercising these rights." But clearly, what he said here at this New York Times thing, that's what he meant. And that's been the reality that workers have faced.
Right, because we have people being fired.
We have over 20 baristas. Over 20 baristas have been fired in retaliation.
And I know you're about to talk about this. We've had an entire store shut down.
Yes.
Just for having the audacity to organize.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we go on to that one, though, just wanting to make sure Josh isn't in the Zoom.
No. Okay. No.
I wonder what happened to that. So yeah, that
maybe he saw your tweet about him.
Maybe.
Josh, if you're listening, no disrespect, but
no
that
disrespect.
Was a bad
tweet. We have respect for your reporting. Your tweets, not so much. So. 20 baristas have been fired, and a store has been closed permanently. And that's what I want to talk about next. Starbucks corporate has decided to close a store in Ithaca, New York, in what can only be seen as a response to unionizing workers, it seems to me. But let's take a look at their official reason. Their official reasoning, they say, that they had to close the store is because a grease trap is broken. Which, if you've ever worked in a restaurant, that makes it very difficult to... For one, very important thing for a restaurant food service type thing is it's very difficult with a broken grease trap to keep the store smelling nice.
And it's definitely a safety hazard.
It is 100%. Definitely a safety hazard.
That's real. But I've also never been in a situation, and I've worked in restaurants that were much more food intensive than Starbucks. And even in those places, I don't see where a broken grease trap would necessitate the shutdown of the entire facility, even if it closed early for a day to get it fixed. Like, that's
exactly.
It. That's the extent of this. This isn't, oh, God, this just right off the whole store. It's closed forever because of the grease trap. Really?
Workers report that this grease trap has been broken for years. For years.
Hence their concern, right? That's a valid concern.
Right. And the workers actually went on a one-day strike to attempt to get corporate to fix it. Because they've been having to deal, you know, corporate hasn't been having to deal with this broken grease trap, customer complaints, the safety issues that are associated with that. They haven't been having to deal with that. The workers have been having to deal with that. And the workers want the issue resolved. So they went on a one-day strike to try to bring corporate attention to this. And now corporate is saying, no, we have to close this location because of the grease trap. We don't think that we can provide the service. Like, you just fix it. You can literally just fix it. And of course, this is silly. Especially when you consider the fact that, according to a local news outlet, this location sits on one of the busiest corners in town. It's also silly when you couple something else that Schultz said in his New York Times fellatio. He said that... He talked about opening a Starbucks in a lower income neighborhood, saying, quote, "I don't know if it'll be profitable, but it doesn't matter because we want to provide a third place or whatever. We want to provide for the community." That's total nonsense. Like, what a liar. What a dirty, weaselly, sniveling liar. I mean, it's insane. So the reason is obviously... because of retaliation. And that brings up the question, how can we do something about this? How can workers do something about this at Starbucks and out of Starbucks? And I think the first thing is that the Starbucks workers have to keep organizing. They have to keep on, because the more stores that you organize, the more power that you have. And eventually, you can reach a density where, whether billionaire Howie wants to or not, he has to pay attention and do what you need him to do.
Right, and keep pressure on the National Labor Relations Board.
Yes.
As we've talked about on this show, they have been a pleasant surprise, one of the few pleasant surprises of the Biden administration. And so I know in their statement, Starbucks Workers United, their attorney, in the statement I saw, he seemed pretty confident that the NLRB was going to intervene here and rule on their behalf. And I would be inclined to think so as well if they're actually following the law, because it is against the law to shut down a facility in retaliation for unionizing.
Right.
But as we also talk about on this show, we can't just leave it in the hands of lawyers and government agencies to do our work.
Right. Exactly. And so, you know, and this is what has happened with the big three automakers. You know, density got to such a point where they were at first reluctant to recognize any union, to bargain with any union. And it got to such a point where, you know, there were so many people that are necessary to bring the profits in to these big automakers that they had to bargain with the union, and they had to give them a lot of the things that they were asking for. So you start to get to a place where you've got 30% of workers at Starbucks across the country unionized, 40%, 50%. 80%, 90%, totally different ballgame. And his ability to do stuff like this is going to be completely different. And on top of the fact that he's closing it, they were only given a week notice, and they were not given transferral rights. They were given the ability to apply to another Starbucks location.
Well, hell, I've got that. I've got the ability to apply.
But even if you had transferral rights, a lot of the people there are college students who don't have cars. They're college students nearby who don't have cars, so they can't go to the next nearest location because they don't have transportation to get there. So, you know, the ability that Starbucks would have to unilaterally make a decision like this, if they have to deal with a national high density Starbucks union, would be greatly, greatly diminished. So that is the first, best, and most effective way to move forward. But there's also, you know, another way is like Adam said, state action through the NLRB, keeping pressure on the NLRB, and there are other interesting policy proposals out there. And one of them that I want to talk about is the right of first refusal, which is something that Adam and I have been interested in and have wanted to talk about for a while, which is that it's a policy proposal that Jeremy Corbyn put in his Labour Party plan in the UK, which is the outlines.
Now that was a few years ago.
Several years ago, just to clarify,
Jeremy Corbyn is no longer in charge of the Labour Party over there because the right-wing British media and the awful libs inside the corporate wing of the Labour Party helped take him down. Anyway, sorry to get off on that, but still love you, Jeremy.
Yes.
Should have been prime minister.
Should have been prime minister. And Bhaskar Sankara is in Denmark, I think it is now, with Jeremy Corbyn. And Corbyn was he had to take a cab, and the cab driver was Palestinian. And when it came time for him to get off, the cab driver refused any fare, and he was like, "I'll take you anywhere," or something. That was
nice.
That was pretty cool. Yeah. But yeah, so the right of first refusal is a really interesting policy proposal, and I think it makes a lot of sense from any sort of political persuasion that you may be of. I think the right of first refusal is a policy that makes good economical and moral sense. And what it is, it's just a policy that would say that you cannot, as the owner of a company, sell or close or take your business into bankruptcy without first giving the workers the right of first refusal, without first offering them at fair market value the business to take over themselves, to run themselves. And I think this is just the most, even as a conservative, what could possibly be the argument against this? What could possibly be the argument against giving? Because it's not saying that workers have to take it over. If they don't want to, they can just refuse. That's the first right of first refusal. They can have the first refusal. If they don't want it, then somebody else can buy it. They can take it into bankruptcy. They can close it, whatever. If the workers don't want it, then they don't want it. But if they do want it, if the workers do want it, if the people who have run the company actually done the thing, if they would like the opportunity to run it themselves, why should a capitalist have the right to give it to somebody else just because they have the money, because the workers could get the money. The workers could pay him what anybody else would pay him at fair market value.
And think about the way that can impact our community. If you have a facility that's slated to be closed and you have workers who live in these neighborhoods, pay taxes in these neighborhoods, send their school, I mean, their kids to the local schools, they're part of the local churches, mm-hmm. And on and on. And these workers have the ability to purchase the facility themselves, to keep it operational and to move forward in whatever manner they choose,
right.
But in a way that keeps those people employed and keeps the money there in your own community locally. I mean, that really is such a no-brainer in my mind. And
it is.
Ever since I first learned about this years ago, it's just been one of those things that seems so common sense. It's like so common sense. It's too common sense, and that's why it's not part of our discourse.
Right. And the, you know, the incentivization of worker cooperatives as a way to organize production is very good because there are a lot of benefits to worker-owned enterprises. They have obviously, they're better to the workers because the workers own them. They have they tend to have higher wages, better benefits, and things like this. There tends to be more stability because there is more of an interest in actually taking care of the workers during scenarios like an inflation or something. So in a scenario like an inflation, a hierarchical business with a capitalist owner at the top interested in maximizing profits will, generally speaking, fire a bunch of people and you know, there'll be layoffs. Whereas a worker-owned enterprise, there will be more of an interest in potentially tightening belts for the greater good, tightening their belts a little so that everybody can keep their job.
Right.
And you don't have a
layer of management people at the top making obscenely more than the rank and file employees. Right. So that's a huge amount of the company's resources that are tied up. And most companies that you're not going to see in a worker-owned enterprise.
And one of the reasons that we don't see very many worker-owned enterprises is that workers don't have the capital. And so the workers don't have the money to start a business or to buy a business.
And we certainly don't have the legal framework and the policy proposals out there to incentivize this. And even very capitalist countries in other places of the world, you know, like Italy, for example. Italy's a capitalist country. They have probably a better welfare state than we do in some respects. But, I mean, you can't argue. By no means is that a state-owned economy or a workers-owned economy. But in places like Italy, they do have laws and policies in place to facilitate these kinds of businesses.
And one of the ways that you could facilitate, in addition to giving workers the first right of refusal, which is something that Jeremy Corbyn in the UK wanted to do, and he also wanted to do this, is to offer state-backed loans to the workers' organization that they would form to buy the business, to offer them loans from the state, which... Instead of, because banks are much more hesitant to give, you know, business loans to workers than they are to capitalists. And so you could do that through the state. You could have lower interest rates or no interest rate potentially to try to incentivize this choice and give workers, you know, something that capitalists and owners and people that are free market weirdos, they say, oh, choice. I want choice. I want the market, the competition, whatever. And this would actually give workers a real choice about how they want to organize their production, how they want to organize their lives, how they want to organize their workplaces. And it would take, you know, because one of the big, an enormous threat hanging over the heads of working people as we mull over the idea of organizing, of fighting for better wages, better working conditions, more time off the job, more protections, one of the big threats is closure of stores, of closure of businesses. That the biggest threat that the capitalist has is to just pick up his ball and walk home. And this would take that threat away, because if he wants to take his ball and go home, he can walk away. We can give him a fair market value for the business, and we can run it ourselves.
You know, something that this makes me consider is that, to kind of touch on a point you mentioned to me earlier off air about the labor movement and the amount of resources they have now, you know, despite having historically low membership, they have historically high resources.
Right.
I think there's an opportunity here for the labor movement and, you know, more official uniondom to work with and on behalf of a workers' co-op movement. I think there could be a lot more synergy there. I could see labor unions pulling resources to help facilitate these kinds of enterprises.
Mm-hmm.
I think it that has to be something that's on the agenda for all of us that are, you know, of this persuasion, because we have to find ways to concentrate power in our hands. To me, it's always about power. And
right.
How, you know, what better way to gain power than to actually control and own production in your own community?
Yes.
So there's a lot of exciting stuff happening out there. Co-ops and worker-owned enterprises is not my expertise, but it's something I'm really interested in, something I'm always trying to learn more about. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a lot of cool stuff happening in Jackson, Mississippi, less so than it could have been. There's been some really interesting things happening out in Richmond, California, of course, out in Spain. So there are real-world examples that are already out there on how to do these things, policies and laws that can be put in place to facilitate it and to improve it. And I think that's something, you know, and maybe we'll hear a little bit of this at Labor Notes next week. I'd like to hear more from labor unions and union people talking with co-op and worker-owned enterprise people and how we can more work together to grow both.
Right.
Because I think it takes both, and I think we got to approach it from both angles. Because, you know, wouldn't it be nice if virtually our entire economy was either worker-owned enterprises and worker-owned co-ops or fully unionized industries?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think that's the sort of transitional goal that we can really be working towards.
And I think that is the ultimate goal is worker-owned enterprises, is that we don't have bosses, is that we run enterprises ourselves.
That's
the historic
mission. In the meantime, like, this unionize, build power in those workplaces. And then, yes, ultimately, this start owning the industries themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that is a pathway for shared prosperity and a pathway for democracy. And that's something Richard Wolff talks a lot about in terms of democracy. And, you know, he typically doesn't use, like, socialism as a label, but focuses more on, you know, economic democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's true, for 8 hours a day or more, we report to a dictatorship.
Right.
And there is another way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if we ever just need to kill time, let's just talk. let's get on this subject, I'm sure we can get fired up about it.
Elon Musk tweeted again last week.
I'd rather he not.
Yeah,
actually, I don't know. It's kind of good in a way that he just like shows his ass publicly,
yes.
So everybody can see it. Because my hope is that just ordinary people who maybe don't follow political media very much or news media very much, I hope that the perception of Elon Musk has taken a hit.
I hope so too.
I think it has. I mean,
surely,
I don't have any
right?
data behind that. I've just, you know, my gut instinct is that surely he's not as like well liked and well respected as he was years ago.
It can't be. I remember a couple years ago I was working in a restaurant. Or this was, 4 or 5 years ago now. This conversation probably would have been happening in 2016, I guess. Jesus Christ. Anyway, this guy, big Bernie bro, loves Bernie Sanders. I don't think he wouldn't consider himself a socialist, but big progressive Democrat Bernie guy, hates, you know, the establishment, corporate Democrats or whatever. I remember us having a conversation about Elon Musk and me not being, you know, I was just kind of starting to get into politics. I didn't really know anything about Elon Musk, and I was just kind of listening to him, like, just totally go on about this guy. And I remember the words, they're stuck in my mind, because I was like, I'm not totally sure about that, but maybe, who knows? He said, Elon Musk is going to save the world.
And, how's that going?
He does not have that opinion anymore. Thank God.
Yeah. But, he was not alone, though.
No, he wasn't. It wasn't even, that was like, that would not have been an odd opinion to have, even among Bernie Sanders voters at the time, I don't think. Right?
Yeah, and I think that's also a reflection of people seeing that government has been dysfunctional and not helpful for decades now by design, right? So, of course, if the public sector has more or less abandoned hope, people start looking for private folks to swoop in and start addressing these crises and these problems that the government is either unwilling or incapable of addressing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the perception of clean energy capitalists has been problematized, has been complicated a lot over the last 2 years, I think, in particular, which is really good, because electric car capitalists, electric car bosses, solar bosses, windmill bosses, they're bosses. And in many ways, as far as the working conditions are concerned, they are even worse than fossil fuel bosses. Of course, fossil fuel bosses are responsible for, you know, climate change and things like this, and keeping that from the public for decades after they knew it was an issue and continuing to advocate against solutions. But as far as the workers are concerned, renewable energy, electric car manufacturing are among the least unionized sectors in the country, and the working conditions are worse for it. The pay is lower, the protections are lower, there are more cases of discrimination, more safety incidents, all of this stuff from, you know, the capitalists who are going to save us, right?
Right. I mean, ultimately, the pursuit of private profit is what led us down this road of climate catastrophe. And so
it's not going to get us out.
Right. Why? You know, it boggles my mind. Why would you believe that the same motivations and the same people, largely, certainly the same class of people, why are they going to get us out if they got us into this mess?
Right. They're not. So Elon Musk tweeted again last week. He said, everyone eats the same food, uses the same restrooms, etc. No executive chef or other ivory tower stuff. There shouldn't be this workers versus management two-class system. Everyone is a worker. That's what he tweeted last week.
How can you even say that with a straight face?
We're talking about literally the wealthiest man in the world who is going around to these big parties, partying with child rapists on, Jeffrey Epstein and company. His workers aren't doing that.
Yeah, I just want to put it out there. I've never met Ghislaine Maxwell.
Right.
Never been at the same party as her.
Never been at the same party as her.
I don't get those invites.
Yeah. Don't have a picture with her.
Don't want them, but just putting that out there. Nobody I know ever been invited.
We talked earlier in the show about economic populist being tortured in an Orwellian fashion. And this sentence, this tweet, is also just incredibly Orwellian.
Don't believe your lying eyes.
And I'm sure that Steve Cortez would also call Elon Musk an economic populist. It's amazing that you can say this. And the same week, literally the same week, More Perfect Union reported that Elon Musk is about to collect a $23 billion bonus as Tesla cuts 10% of its staff. He's taking home more than 340,000 times the median U.S. household income as a bonus while putting hundreds of workers out of a job.
Wow.
That's the same week that he said everyone is a worker. There shouldn't be this workers versus management two class system. Everyone eats the same food, uses the same restroom, etc. Well, evidently not, because 10% of your workers are no longer going to have access to the restroom. They're no longer going to have access to the food because they're going to get kicked out because you are firing them while you're taking a $23 billion bonus.
340,000 times the median U.S. household income as a bonus.
Jesus Christ.
That's, I mean, we're talking numbers so big that, like, our brains struggle to
they're like
conceive of them mathematically.
They are so large, it's meaningless. The idea of having 340, I make approximately the median household income in the United States, I think. The idea of having 340,000 times more than what I do now is a meaningless proposition to me. It is a meaningless amount of money. It's so large. And he's taking that amount of money as a bonus while he puts, estimates are, 10,000 workers out of a job.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this with the Left Reckoning guys. I guess that was last week. But Tesla has always just been such a scammy kind of company.
Oh, yes.
Where it's clearly been a stock speculator. I mean, speculation in stocks has been a key driver of Tesla, because in no way have the stock prices of Tesla actually matched up with the profits.
They're the most highly valued car company in the U.S., and they make the least amount of cars.
Right. If you go on Robinhood and, you know, you want to put your little $100 in the stock market, and you flip through and you see Ford, you know, $12 a share, Tesla, $800 a share. What?
It's crazy.
I mean, come on now. Don't tell me about the logic of the market and how the market is rational and it just works all this stuff out with supply and demand, and, you know, it's really bizarre. And I think so much of Tesla and Elon Musk is all image. The guy that you worked with who thought, well, this guy's going to save the world. I mean, he's carefully cultivated that sort of persona.
Right.
And his companies are so much tied to that persona. So it will be interesting to see, as that persona kind of takes a hit and people aren't buying it, are they going to stop buying his companies as well? Mm-hmm. I mean, the Tesla stock has tanked quite a bit since his whole purchasing Twitter fiasco. We don't know how that's going to shake out, but
yeah. Jeb in the chat said, in Elon's defense, if my family owned an emerald mine in an apartheid state, I might be pro-capitalism too. And that's true.
Right. And I'm sure that may also explain why he isn't too concerned about racial discrimination inside of his facilities.
Right.
I'm guessing he didn't have the most forward-thinking ideas about race in his household growing up.
Yeah. No kidding. It's crazy. I do, because so much of Tesla is a brand management thing. It's not tied. The idea that Tesla's share price is tied to the product it produces is ludicrous. It's all brand management. And so it will be interesting to see, as his brand value declines, how much the price of Tesla and SpaceX declines. That will be interesting to see. So I think that's going to be it for us this week. I did have something pulled up that I wanted to talk about, a tweet from Josh Moon. But he showed an interest potentially in talking about it with us. So maybe we can get him on a future program to talk about it. And if we don't get him on a future program, then we'll just talk about it ourselves.
Yeah, I think that sounds good. Definitely want him to be able to you know, speak for himself on it.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we said, due respect to his investigative journalism. There's not many of those in Alabama, so.
Right. And you're certainly not going to get it on, you know, like talk radio.
Oh, hell no. Definitely not.
Or these 18, 19 news weirdos.
Yeah, I've seen billboards for them.
Have you really?
I could have swore I saw a billboard for 1819 News here in the Huntsville area. So there's definitely some money being put behind this product.
Imagine what we could do if we were given the ability to not only do this full time ourselves, like as far as our labor time, but to have the resources that they do. I mean, we do this once a week on our off time while both of us work full time, more than full time, while both of us are union activists, just barely scraping enough money to break even. And imagine how much we, and with all of that said, our online audience is five times more conservatively than the Koch-funded weirdo, Phil Williams. Imagine what we could do with the resources that he, with like half the resources that he has.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
it would be amazing.
I look at the quality.
We would be a juggernaut.
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah. I mean, the quality of the product that we put out, all those things considered and put in context. Look at some of the interviews that we've done, some of the, you know, policy discussions we've had. I think we've put out a lot of great stuff considering, yeah, it is on a shoestring budget as just a hobby on our off time. And these folks, that if you tune into the radio, these folks are doing this as like a full-time job with big money behind them.
3 hours of content every single day for one of these people. For one of these people.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we could do. I think we could do a lot better.
Yeah.
And we're not radio experts. We don't know a whole lot about media and working in the media because that's not our thing. We didn't go to school for that. We just do this because we love unions and think there should be news and media for and about working class people. So. For any of you who are tuning in and you agree with that, you probably already contribute, frankly, if you're still listening. So I just wanted to say thank you for that. Yeah. And if you know anybody who does not know about our show yet, try to get them tuned in. Share our stuff with them. Invite them to like the page on Facebook or, you know, subscribe on YouTube. Those little things, they do help. Especially if you already contribute financially or you just can't afford to financially. Yeah, I definitely feel that the subscriptions, the likes, the shares, that's a way you can really help us. And it doesn't cost you anything but a little bit of your time.
Yep. All right, folks. Yeah, that'll be it for us this week. We appreciate your time. If you want to leave us a voicemail through the week, share a bad boss story, an organizing win, ask us a question, a topic suggestion, feel free to give us a call, leave us a voicemail. The phone number is 844-899-TVLR. You can also send us a text. We'll get that as well. If you would like to support the program, you can do that on patreon.com/TheValleyLaborReport or on our website where you can also get our hat, tvlr.fm. Find us online, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, TikTok, all those places, wherever you get your podcasts. We appreciate your time, and we'll see you next week.
Bye, y'all. Solidarity forever.